The Local Government News Roundup is proudly supported by Davidson. For 30 years, Davidson has been strengthening the local government sector by identifying and providing the people, expertise and experience that local government needs to enhance its capability, productivity and performance. Davidson is nationally recognised for its executive recruitment services and over the past 4 years has built a business advisory practice rapidly evolving into one of the nation's foremost and trusted local government business consultancy firms. The Davidson methodology and approach is simple. Thinking beyond now and aiming to be a valued partner with your local government, not just for the immediate project, but for the next 30 years. Speak to Justin Hanney or Seamus Scanlon to find out more, or head to davidsonwp.com.au. Davidson, your future, your partner. I'm Chris Eddy. Welcome to Roundup Unfiltered, another special edition from the Local Government News Roundup, brought to you by the Victorian Local Governance Association and Davidson Recruitment and Business Advisory Services. Today's guest is an acclaimed author, speaker and culture transformation expert. Diane Kalin-Sucre joins me from Canada to share insights from over two decades of senior leadership, including an award-winning tenure as a city manager and as a producer for a national television program on the CBC network. Diane's published works include the book Save Your City, How Toxic Culture Kills Community and What to Do About It. It's being celebrated with a fifth anniversary edition this year. For years now, Diane has been travelling the length and breadth of Canada and beyond, calling for a revival of civic values and civic education as the key to fostering the type of culture that can sustain us, our democracy and our planet. Stand by now for an all-new edition of Roundup Unfiltered. Lovely to have you on the program, Diane. Welcome.
Great to be here. Honoured.
Tell me a little bit about your local government background. You were a chief executive officer?
Yes. Well, one of the interesting things about local government is that we all have a fascinating path. You know, I certainly didn't begin my career thinking I want to be a municipal CAO or chief executive officer, as you call them. I think for me, my interest in community building really began at quite a young age. I always seemed to have a natural concern for the fragility of democracy and a sense that, you know, so I ended up studying political economy, political science, political philosophy, and I kind of pretty much had a solid classical education that I then took into various fields. So, and one of those ended up being much, you know, similar to your kind of experience in working in media, in the media industry. I was a national television producer for our public broadcaster, CBC, and we had a program that actually went across the country. And, you know, that was over 20 years ago. And at that time, we knew there was already a democratic deficit happening at our local level. And, you know, I think for local government officials, we can recognize people have been around for about 20 years, know that for years we were begging people to come to our meetings, right? And so this was around those times where apathy was really the problem as opposed to a lot of negative engagement. And so what we were doing was we were setting up town halls across the country of local governments and communities that were facing dramatic changes due to globalization pressures. So for instance, if a particular municipality was facing a vast expansion of industrial hog farming or another one facing water privatization or something from a multinational, and then kind of helping that community model a town hall that we would then broadcast nationally. And we would set it up so that there was a true democratic discussion going on. You'd have people on all sides of the issue, elected officials, staff, experts from both sides, and then have the public in attendance and an ability for people to ask questions and ultimately help that civil discourse in taking place. And so that also really shaped my thinking. That program was eventually ended by the broadcaster, and you know, something much more entertainment-like was its replacement. But you know, I did find my way back to local government through the corporate officer. I'm not sure what you call them in Australia, but it, like the clerk position, that route. And I was as surprised as anyone when I finally was a municipal chief administrative officer. And I think today a lot of our staff are much more, you know, when they're looking at taking a job in a particular municipality, they think, you know, once, twice, and three times, and they investigate the current culture of the municipality, its governance challenges, and its sustainability, and you know, how well received their contribution will be. And we see this in local governments being challenged in terms of recruiting qualified staff. And at that time, that was around 10 years ago, I didn't think so carefully when I was taking a job. And I ended up in a municipality that I knew had some challenges, but really what we would recognize it as today would be a municipality facing governance collapse. And I know you report on these kinds of things. It's actually now part of the daily occurrences. And, you know, in England, they have about 1 in 5 municipalities that are facing bankruptcy, you know, and for me, as a Canadian, I was astounded that we had municipalities that would be challenged in, you know, submitting financials, that would have no functioning, you know, records management system, the public record, you know, wasn't functioning, or that we would be challenged in meeting basic statutory requirements, or, you know, having qualified people to operate the water and sewer systems, or just have legal challenges against it because of the inability to meet basic legal requirements. So that was shocking to me. And so I was actually in a way quite eager and honored to take on the challenge of rebuilding that municipality. And to give some sense of the impact of civic leadership, you know, there was an election that brought in a brand new council that was prepared to make the, you know, to rebuild the municipality. And, you know, so we had that alignment of elected officials and staff, and it was really a rather miraculous transformation within the term of one council. We were able to turn a municipality around into a multi-award winning municipality, and everything from, we won awards against, you know, not against, but with friendly competition that we have in the municipal sector, a much larger municipalities in areas of good governance, in organizational development, in community partnerships, in asset management, sustainable community building. And there was just this great enthusiasm behind the whole thing. And you can do that. I mean, it is possible to turn an organization around in a short period of time, particularly if it's smaller. It takes a bit longer for larger organizations. But, you know, as an organizational transformation, you know, a person who's done a lot of this work, it can be between 5 and 10 years. But a community culture takes much longer. It's more like a generation. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that became clear to me in this journey was that a government that, you know, the local government that's facing governance collapse, or even just challenges regarding its infrastructure or financing or staffing or any of these things, it's, you know, a sustainable local government has a sustainable culture that accompanies it. All institutions have a culture that undergird them. And so I became really, you know, this experience, and plus some of the work that I'd done before in my journey, made me really aware of how important culture was to good governance and to the functioning of our communities, and also how unaware we were in our sector that this was a primary area of focus, something that we could not neglect. And because there are so many, you know, pressures on local government, you know, it seems like just one more thing. But in my view, it was critically important. And that's kind of how all of this began.
So you wrote the book, Save Your City. Was the book written while you were still a CAO, or was this a project you took on when you left local government?
That's a fascinating question, because in one way, it was actually being written in my mind my entire life. Yeah. And when I finally left local government, you know, I do have 4 children, so I know what it feels like to be pregnant. And it was very much like being pregnant. Like, I could not write the book. Like, I just had to give birth to this thing. And for a few reasons. The first one was that I wanted to raise the alarm bells that, you know, our political culture in our country was deteriorating, that this was not just an individual problem, but a social problem that was going to affect the ability of our governments to govern themselves. And that incivility, you know, it spreads like a contagion unless you address culture intentionally. So there was that impact. I was also concerned by what I was seeing, on the levels of trauma that were, happening within our sector. A lot of public servants were just like ordinary folk, right? People who run for council they didn't sign up to be president of the United States and have security details and mass groups of people being, sometimes now a story can go viral and all of a sudden a small town mayor is like all over the international news. For something that they didn't even realize was an infraction in the first place, right? So it can be a very volatile world, a very volatile situation. And I wanted to talk about political culture as something that we needed to address. But also one of the concerns that I had was the need to build a shared understanding between civic leaders and citizens. There seems to be this huge divide. And I think it's primarily due to a lack of civic education. Between the works and efforts and, mechanisms and, what's going on at the local government level and what citizens understand about it. And the book's actual title is Save Your City, and then it's How Toxic Culture Kills Community and What to Do About It. And one of the challenges is that when we are in a toxic environment, it's not just that, people don't decide to do it. Oftentimes it's like being in a dysfunctional family. You think that's normal behavior. People think the way to get things done sometimes is in a very negative way that has maybe they succeed in achieving their goal of stopping that policy or that initiative or intimidating someone into submission, but they don't often recognize the impact that that has, like a reverberating impact on the culture. It becomes the way things get done. And once you have that kind of a dynamic going on, then people are living in fear, they're living in intimidation, there was a new report. This is probably one of the reasons why this never-ending tour, I'm always on this tour because the problem is escalating. And there was a report that just came out three weeks ago in the United States showing that not only is incivility rising in our communities, but in frequency, but also in the degrees of abuse. So what we were seeing maybe a few years ago was, derogatory remarks, insults, efforts to humiliate people. How people did politics, to escalations of more and more harassment we're seeing now, more and more threats, and actually now violence. And this is the case even I'm experiencing on my tour, where I used to get calls primarily for, this is happening, sometimes like psychological harassment or, people doing like little, sidebar campaigns against them or divisions on council. But now more than ever, I'm getting calls from people who are afraid for their safety, elected officials who are afraid for their safety, staff who are afraid for their safety. And I remember in 2018, when I did my first keynote address on this topic, it was to a large group of senior leaders and some elected officials. And, the room was pretty silent. People had never heard of this issue, really. I mean, in Canada, maybe it was a little bit more advanced in Australia at the time, definitely so in England. But in Canada, we were in a widespread denial that there was a cultural problem. And when I talked about how incivility, once unleashed, spreads like a contagion and will eventually end up in violence, people, I think, for the most part, really didn't believe me. And it took a bit of a, but now, I mean, it seems to be like everybody understands that we've got to find a way to address it. And that's the $1 million question. Like, how do you actually do it? And I think that that's where I wanted to have a serious contribution. Usually when we're in the crisis, we want just to solve our problem. Like if we have a vexatious, citizen who's making our life very difficult, we want to like stop that from happening. Or if we have a conflict on council, we want somebody to mediate or resolve it. But really, these are what I call, just coping mechanisms. Less so, you can maybe resolve the issue, but don't actually solve the problem, the bigger problem. And so I wanted to point people to the fact that while we can, and it is important to invest a certain amount of energy in coping with the situation, we also must simultaneously invest energy in civic culture renewal and actually transforming the culture, because you can't just legislate civility and civil discourse. Like, it has to flow from the heart. It has to become part of our ethos, which is actually the democratic ethos and a muscle that we just haven't been using for really too long.
Diane, are you describing behavior that occurs between elected representatives, between elected reps and council staff, or between those groups and members of the community, or like a multiple choice question? Is it all of the above?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Local Government News Roundup is brought to you by the Victorian Local Governance Association. As Victorian councils go to elections later this year, the VLGA is ready to support communities and councils in good governance. A series of workshops has been designed to increase understanding of the local government sector, the work of councils, and the role of a councillor. Registrations are being taken now for workshops in May on standing for local government and local women leading change. And member councils should look out for the VLGA's 2024 Local Government Election Pre-Candidate Prospectus, available soon. Find out more about how the VLGA can support your council and community during this important time in the local government election cycle. Visit vlga.org.au.
It's absolutely all the blob. There are no innocent parties. This is the interesting thing. We've all been implicated in this. And so we should stop trying to point fingers and say, you know, it really is. Local government doesn't exist separate from society. And for years we've heard, you know, stop bullying in the schools and bullying in the workplaces and bullying everywhere. Well, of course it's infected our local governments. And all you have to do is look at the headlines, you know, like, you know, citizens, you know, spreading sewage all over the city manager's home. And then you've got, you know, city managers implicated in unethical conduct. And then you have, you have elected officials. So it's happening at the board level. It's happening vertically. It's happening horizontally. And it's even happening, you know, among frontline civic workers. And we have some municipalities where, you know, they've done third party surveys and found that 50% of the public servants, like the front, not the elected officials, not the senior staff, but our civic workers, are facing gross levels of harassment. It's not just vertical. It's from the public. It's from each other. You know, we've lost the art of living and working well together. And so it's natural that we kind of look to tools. And this is the thing, because I often describe this whole process of cultural transformation as being like frogs in a tepid pot of water that's slowly being brought to a boil. So we haven't really, you know, it's just sort of crept up on us. And, you know, one of the things that we started to do about 10 years ago is we felt the pressure, we felt the anxiety, and we started to, you'll see it at the, you know, elected official conventions or at the staff conventions, we started to have little wellness sessions, or we started to have conversations about personal resiliency, not really fully understanding that resiliency requires, you know, social resiliency. You can only be so personally resilient if an environment's toxic, right? Mm-hmm. And then we didn't want to talk really about culture. So we focused our attention on political acuity. And, you know, political acuity is necessary. I pride myself in having it. I'm sure you do as well. You need to be really agile, you know, ninja-like, Houdini-like, to survive a difficult political environment. However, I find, you know, most people engaging in politics today have some of those skills. It's when political acuity becomes a substitute for actually addressing truly toxic cultural situations that, you know, that's its limitation. And then there were lots of discussions at the municipal level around, you know, legal budgets getting way out of control because there was excessive reliance on lawyers to kind of solve problems. And this misconception that just because something's legal, that it's actually ethical. And I think we now are starting to have an understanding that that's not the case and that we are being held to a higher standard. And then we thought maybe the problem could be solved by simply increasing security. That, you know, we just needed to protect people. Of course, WorkSafe required violence assessment plans, and we had to protect staff and City Hall. And again, widespread denial. Like, even, you know, we just had a shooter come into one of our city halls, and it was probably one of the first times ever anything like that's happened in Canada. And it's funny because, like, it's human psychology. We immediately go, the problem's contained. It's a one-off. It has nothing to do with anywhere else. It's never going to happen again. You know, we've got all the security in place. And in reality, yes, in a way, okay, that's great. But the truth is, you know, we never used to have people coming in shooting in local government. We never used to have people driving their vehicles into City Hall. We never had to armor up our, and now it's necessary. And now we, in most of our large cities, our elected officials have security, not just, you know, in the course of their work, but also in their homes. And so this just goes to show it's not a solution. It's a coping mechanism to a, you know, advancing cultural problem.
And you describe a number of coping mechanisms, Diane, and I have noticed some similarities between Canada and here in terms of the use of codes of conduct, and a lot of conduct matters getting more and more attention in the press, but also we have this, we're in this phase of the government putting in municipal monitors and administrators, in some cases removing entire councils because they've become dysfunctional. Has the problem gotten to that extreme in Canada as well?
Oh, absolutely. It's exactly there and probably at a very similar timing. So it was around, you know, 5-6 years ago that provinces began requiring local governments to have codes of conduct. And so you had charters and municipal acts all amended to do that. And, you know, except in my province, it's one of the few it's voluntary, but every council must by law consider whether or not they're going to have a code of conduct within mm-hmm. 6 months of being elected. And then there's all those requirements around training and renewal every year and all of that. Ontario is the most stringent in terms of, they were one of the first ones out the gate to require, which is our largest province, to require codes of conduct. But they also require all municipalities to appoint integrity commissioners to kind of adjudicate those code of conduct violations. And, you know, I have been listening to your podcast. I'm so grateful for the service that you're providing. It's rich, filled with information, and I think really goes a long way to help civic leaders understand that the problems that we're facing are really quite universal, and therefore so must be some of the solutions, right? So we are having, so Ontario has gone the furthest, and their bodies, like the Association of Municipalities of Ontario, have done some thorough analysis of the way that's actually impacted them. And they do have some concerns. So what we are finding is that they are requesting better standardized training for integrity commissioners, for instance, because, you know, I think about it this way. Jane Jacobs, who's a great, you know, North American urbanist, well respected, you know, 20 years ago talked about the mass amnesia that accompanies a society and cities on the verge of cultural collapse, that they can no longer remember, you know, the democratic principles and practices upon which they're founded. So even if we're hiring lawyers, you know, just because someone's been a lawyer, it doesn't mean that they fully understand the municipal context. And often there's confusion even amongst ourselves, even with this fact that we have to, you know, you're bringing in monitors to train people. We don't have comprehensive civic education programs. So we're actually getting in this situation where almost every election, we're having to provide very comprehensive, you know, education on basic principles regarding democratic governance. And if we want to be a self-governing people, this is a very onerous, you know, way to approach things. But the next frontier in Ontario was also the issue of elected officials. You know, the big mayors actually joined together. There was a bill introduced to expand the code of conduct to elected officials who were behaving in ways that violated the rights and safety of employees. And that was ultimately voted down. But we do have situations where, for instance, elected officials are, you know, engaging in like sexual harassment or things that were really, really concerning. And I think that, and the recourse, like there's concern around that there's very little recourse to actually a sanction, a 90-day sanction being not sufficiently effectual. But again, I mean, all of this points to the fact that these are not solutions. These are just very costly. Like there seems to be universal concern with cost. Like one of our municipalities in British Columbia just introduced a code of conduct a year ago, City of Kamloops. And within a year, they've had 17 complaints. They can't make it through, you know, they're still going through 10 of them. Many of them are considered, you know, they're not going to go anywhere. They've cost the municipality over $100,000. This concern with cost is everywhere. And it is very expensive to not know how to get along. It's like, you know, it's like people who complain about having gone through a divorce, you know, it's very, very costly, right? And yes, so,
Diane, if I can just jump in on that point, and we've had this similar criticism here, not only about the cost, but also concerns that the process, which can be very timely, as in take up a lot of time, doesn't mm-hmm. actually resolve any problems at the end and, in fact, entrenches amongst the parties some of that hostility, some of that acrimony, so that you get to the end of the process and nothing's resolved effectively. Do you see it that way also?
I do see it and I do understand it. And that even happens in situations where the resolutions is what people apparently thought they wanted. Like say they wanted to sanction a particular counselor sanctioned, you know, but it only makes matters worse. People are only more angry. And you find this is the same situation and oftentimes in labor situations and organizations, or like where you have a strike. Okay, the strike may have resolved, but then the negative feelings drag on for, you know, decades sometimes, right? And so, you know, I think that is part of the, I'm sure some of that could be improved with better training, but it's no substitute for knowing how to get along and respect each other and being able to flexibly engage in discourse and be really have an appetite for arriving at what is good, what is true, and what is in the common interest. Like if that appetite doesn't exist, it's funny because like Socrates said 2,500 years ago that the greatest evil that a people, that a city can suffer is the hatred of civil discourse. Like to not have that appetite to work together to arrive at is what's in the best interest, and to put aside our minor differences or our you know personal animosities. It's the beginning. It's the beginning of a very difficult, very strenuous road of you know where the social fabric just continues to tear. And unfortunately, civic leaders are so much more influential than they realize. And I think that's one of the things, particularly, I'm being called in a lot of places where we're having, you know, entire states or entire provinces where huge turnover, like you have 50% of the elected officials are brand new. And one of the things that escapes them is their actual power, their actual responsibility, their actual ability to shape culture and the extent to which people are watching them. Like, what hope do we have of talking about civility up in the citizen level when our counselors are behaving in ways that are, you know, certainly not model behavior. And so it's a bit of a realization process. And when people are going through these difficulties, you can't tell them, like, it is important to protect people today. It is important to arrive at certain levels of, you know, there has to be some justice. There has to be the ability to move on, but it's not the ideal. It's not the ideal solution. Like what we really need, I think, is a cultural renewal and an awareness of our personal responsibilities in doing that. And one of the ways that I do that with elected officials and staff is to persuade them that what we're facing is an actual risk, that toxic culture, that this kind of conflict, this protracted conflict, and even like the lust for destruction. We have more and more people getting elected that are just trying to like, that are actually aiming for a certain level of chaos. Or we have people who ought to know better, people who were elected and didn't get elected, then mobilizing little mobs, you know, to, you know, when they should be the people who are helping us create, you know, build those bridges of understanding between civic leaders and citizens, because our municipalities are facing tsunamis of challenges, unprecedented challenges. So we really, this is the time when we need each other to collaborate and cooperate.
So just before we talk a bit about what you do see as potentially the solution, you talked a little earlier about the education that needs to happen after people get elected. We've seen here in Victoria in recent time the introduction of mandatory training for candidates to try and elevate the level of understanding of the role that they're putting their hands up for. The flip side of that can be just this week, nominations have closed for local government elections in Queensland in Australia, and the Electoral Commissioner says the introduction of mandatory training may have resulted in less people nominating because they didn't want to go through that training. How do you respond to that as a measure that would or would not be effective in this space?
Right. I don't think at all that it's a democratic infringement to require or expect or to offer training for candidates. I think it's actually a great service. And I think, though, to help make that argument, we need people to be outspoken. We need experienced civic leaders to speak out and say, and I'm seeing this happening in Canada. We're seeing it happen definitely in the United States in many places. You know, just a few weeks ago, we had one of the longest serving mayors in Canada speak out and say, you know, finally say it. We have a major civility crisis on our hands, something like he hasn't seen in 36 years as an elected official. And we do need to up the ante. We do need to communicate. We do need to remind ourselves of some basic principles, because the kind of culture that we're fostering is antithetical to democracy. Like, that's what they used to call mob rule. You know, it was called ochlocracia. And mob rule is the antithesis of democratic rule. So I think any type of training is good, but I also think that it makes sense for elected officials on a very public way to campaign for improved education at the elementary school level, At the university level, our civic education has declined to levels that are intolerable. You can't sustain a society without maintaining the values that support it. And basic civic values and basic civic education, I think, are critical. But that includes also when elected officials go through their, you know, what we typically call charm school. We really only talk to them about, when we talk about ethics, we normally focus on some really like, you know, conflict of interest, but not really, you know, some of the deeper issues around our obligations to each other, our duties as citizens, you know, what the meaning of servant leadership. Like, I think in some fields, you can have a choice about what type of leadership style you want to adopt. In the public service, it's servant leadership. And what does that look like? And that's important because people come to local government from not necessarily the public sector, not necessarily, you know, they may be a total command and control kind of person. They may have, you know, some admiration of authoritarian leaders, but this is a democratic system. And what does that actually mean? And I think also certain social emotional skills are super important to do some training around resiliency, and empathy has declined at exceptional levels. And it really has been the historic role of civic leaders to weave together the social fabric. So I'm in favor of all forms of training that are being offered. And I would hope that there would be open-mindedness in people to participate in it, because we need like people who are champions of democracy wherever we can get them.
You've talked about the role of ethical behavior in and its influence on cultures, and the flip side of that is unethical cultures, and this concept of ethical fading. Can you explain to me what ethical fading is?
Yes, it's actually very concerning. It's a social phenomenon that happens to people in groups. You know, it's often said that people will do things in groups that they wouldn't do alone. And it's almost like, you know, I'm trying to give you an example of in a municipal sector, what would happen. You know, for the most part, we have, you know, quite ethical, you know, our local government institutions are relative to other levels of government. There are higher levels of trust. Even a study just came out a couple of days ago from the National Research Institute in the United States. You know, local government is still the most trusted. I mean, it's low at 45%, but it's higher than other levels. So I don't want to raise the alarm bells on this, but wherever there has been unethical conduct in local government, you will find lots of people involved in it, and people who were otherwise know better, people who would see themselves as ethical, or who, when put under an examination after the fact, would tell themselves that's not in alignment with my values. And it could be something as simple as administrative assistance for directors or for civic leaders having a practice of just letting a few, you know, personal receipts slide or something, right? And that just being a practice that's so common that, and there may be some, there's a justification that happens in the group, and it becomes normalized. So that's really what ethical fading is when people are brought down collectively by, usually it's a leadership problem, you know, when unethical behavior goes unchecked, or, you know, without accountability, and often, you know, sometimes promoted, those are environments where you see lots of ethical fading, because a person has to leave ultimately if they want to, you know, not be involved in these kind of daily compromises that happen. Mm. So it's really important to talk a lot about ethics. In fact, in the ancient Greek context, this is where we get the very idea of politics. Politics and ethics were inseparable. They were considered like identical issues, because politics was the issue of how do we, you know, ethics can only exist between two people or more. And politics is the activity of leading two people or more in a community context, right? And so how can we do politics without talking about ethics? And like I said, for too long, we've thought that the ethical thing to do is what the lawyer tells us we can get away with. And that's absolutely not the case. We're called to a much higher standard. And when people are behaving in ways that are ethical, it has a ripple effect of flourishing. And that's the very reason why we're in local government. We keep thinking that the reason why local government exists is to provide services. And that's how we achieve our why. The real why of local government, which has historically always been, is to bring about human flourishing, what the ancient Greeks used to call eudaimonia. And this is not just something I'm making up. If you look in any municipal charters, I haven't looked in the Australian ones, but if you look in the US and all Canadian jurisdictions and you look up the purposes of municipal government, it says to provide for the social, economic, and environmental well-being of people.
It's much the same in Australia. Very similar words.
Yes, it doesn't surprise me. To me, it's like this ancient remnant. It was like in the Athenian constitution, right? And because that really is our mandate. That's why we live together in cities. And that's why it's important to live by the golden rule. That's why it's important. Like, who are the standard bearers for that? It's civic leaders. It's like the greatest task. You know, it'd be like a, you know, coach on the sports field. Well, the field for the civic leaders is it's the garden of community. It's you know, their task is to cultivate it in the proper way, to provide the proper nutrition, the proper lighting, you know, and by engaging in behaviors that are toxic, it's like feeding the weeds and stifling the oxygen. Like, we can measure if we're doing well as a community when the people in our society are doing well. And there are some municipalities you see adopting these like well-being budgets where they're actually starting to measure these things. And it really is the case that we measure what we treasure, right? And in my view, it should be well-being, right?
So, Diane, you talk about civic culture renewal as the answer to this issue of toxicity and incivility. Are there any examples of where this has actually turned around a culture to the point where you'd be happy to say that this place is an exemplar?
Well, one of the things with renewal is that it's constant, and that you know, it can't even stop for a second. It's like a garden. If you don't water it one day, it starts to decay in that particular area. So you're never going to get it. I mean, this is an aspirational goal. You're never going to get a situation that it's in the ultimate, in all aspects of society, they've solved the homelessness problem. Everyone treats each other with respect and dignity. But there are initiatives. And what I did in establishing the roadmap to renewing civic culture was looking at some of those causal issues, those systemic issues behind toxic culture, and trying to address them in a systemic way. And what we can do is, like, so I work with civic leaders to come up with their own cultural roadmap, because we all have a different sphere of influence. And, you know, whether you're a citizen or a civic leader, you can have this roadmap and have your particular impact. So what we do see is excellence in certain areas. And, you know, I was particularly impressed, like one of the most impressive civic education initiatives I ever saw was in San Antonio, where the mayor, Ron Nuremberg, you know, declared his city to be a compassionate city. And then he engaged in this mass, I mean, not every municipality can do this. Most municipalities, you know, just don't have the resources. It's like the seventh largest city in the United States. So they are in a different situation, but they did a educational initiative that reached through the entire city hall, through every single educational institution, from the elementary school to high schools, to every college, to every university, because there are massively declining levels of empathy in the United States, in Canada, and around the world, actually, something like 40% decline in the past 20 years. And they've been measuring this since World War II. And so when you have a lack of empathy, you have a lack of social cohesion, you have a lack of care. And so this campaign was all about cultivating empathy, you know, civic duty, community care. And it was a rather extensive educational program that now everyone's participated in. So that would be like a really good example of education. But there are also, you know, without going through the entire renewal map, there are different initiatives. Like, well, the first one begins with being civil and being an upstander yourself. And so I celebrate every civic leader that I see that steps out, you know, and says something, like in the face of, let's say, staff is being mistreated. You'll see some civic leaders punch back and like draw the line and say, that's not acceptable. Or you see other municipalities, for instance, that will begin their council term with a declaration of principles and values that goes even beyond. And then like regular, you know, efforts to renew those and live them out. And, you know, all of it has to do with leadership. But, you know, a mayor could leave or a leader could leave and that initiative could disappear. Mm. I have worked with municipalities that have radically turned around their culture. So we have these culture audits, and you can assess the culture of a municipality, the level of cultural entropy and dysfunction that exists within it. And if you have the courage to look at it, and there are some where you can have even council and staff be willing to look at that dysfunction and to work together with all the staff to move the needle. I've seen that happen, and that happened really effectively, and that massively increases productivity and service delivery. What I do with to convince people on the need for this, because some people can be convinced on the basis of what's right and what's just, you know, and I think others need to see that this is actually something mandatory because it's costing us way too much money. Like, if we look at what all of these, you know, what we call the coping mechanisms are costing us. That would, like I said, in my view, is a culture risk. And so I do believe that with all risks, managers and leaders are responsible to manage risks. And that would involve a first understanding that we have a problem, looking at some of the root causes of it, assessing what it's costing the municipality to be dysfunctional and or toxic or not to have a culture that supports good governance, and then be able to diagnose where their culture is and ultimately to address it. So, you know, it was very saddening to see in 2021, I believe it was during COVID, when that Handforth Parish Council meeting
went viral. Yes, it's true.
Yes,
Jackie
and I'm
Weaver.
What impact it had in Australia. Was that kind of a surprise for people?
Look, it made news, and people, I think, were shocked and appalled and amused by it, which seems to be the range of reactions, doesn't it?
It really does. And, you know, it was embarrassing, of course, but I think it's a good exercise for all of us to ask ourselves, you know, that could happen to any one of us. And it was educational for the public. I think so much of the public had no idea that type of paralysis is not just in Handforth, it's in too many places. A kind of honest reflection, I would say, even for students to look at what actually happens in that kind of a case. Like, look at that level of reactivity. You know, how much trust is lost in that? You know, how much reputational damage happens? What would be the morale of the employees after something like that? You know, we do know a couple of those elected officials resigned. We know that they had to do costly elections. We know there was an investigation that was like over, you know, £85,000 in cost. And again, like you said, the ultimate resolution is not necessarily positive, right? Like, after all is said and done, it's a lot of money, a lot of negative energy expended. And there just simply is no substitute. We can't outsource leadership. You know, I'm reminded of what Plato said, 2,500 years ago, that the city is what it is because the people are what they are. And we've got to be good, ethical people. I mean, there's no substitute for that. And I think that, that's kind of what is an inspiration for me. And no doubt anyone who's passionate about local government and, you know, strong communities.
Diane, what do you, just very quickly, what do you advise civic leaders who come across those people who just simply do not accept that they should be held to those sorts of standards, that it's their right to behave however they wish? They might in some cases have been elected to go down a certain path and they have the support behind them. How do you help leaders navigate those issues?
Yes, I think I speak with all this flowery language about love, but what we can, you know, replace it with to make it more palatable for more people is basic humanity. Rather than immediately demonize those individuals, you know, sometimes there are people who you won't get through to, like that's just the case. But I think it's really important that when you have people with what I call this lust for destruction that get elected, that really have a anti-authoritarian mindset, maybe they're anti-tax, they come with vendettas. It's really important to first listen and first understand. And why are they so angry? I mean, we have to accept that there are real reasons why people are angry in society. And when we're facing the kind of loneliness, the disconnection, the financial challenges, the fact that life is so unaffordable for so many that, you know, we no longer have national governments that talk about a job, 100% job economy. I mean, people don't have jobs, right? There's a lot of frustration out there, and some of it is misdirected at the local government. And I've actually seen it happen before where a truly humble local government, you know, council and staff can bring in a people. And this happened where there was a slate of individuals that just spent their entire like time pre-election bashing the local government, bashing all the staff, you know, and actually getting themselves elected and unelecting some long-standing good elected officials. And when they got in there and when the staff humbly showed them the actual books and what was really happening and how much they were doing with so little, these folks had the decency to not only realize that was actually the case, but they actually wrote a letter in the newspaper apologizing and, you know, acknowledging the good work that had been done and committing to continue with it. And that's not always going to be the case, but, but it never hurts to continue. Like, don't join it. You know, if you start to demonize these individuals, they're human beings and they belong in the community. And, you know, in my view, you know, it's always makes the best sense to continue to argue for what is right, for what is true, for what is in the common good, and to work collaboratively as much as you can. And when those folks become incredibly disruptive, if they continue to do that, then there are other mechanisms to deal with it, right? And if it does happen to be the case that you get a whole series of people there that, you know, decommission the local government, well, that is the will then of the people, because they've allowed that to happen. I mean, you can't stop a people who are not, don't want, you know, how much, you know, it's happened in, we have entire jurisdictions in Canada where they have to extend the nomination periods because nobody's coming forward to run for office, you know. It's just such a shame. And it's made people who sacrificed their lives, you know, for democracy, it brings them to tears. Like, how could this actually be? Mm. But it is the reality, and we need to live within reality and to build from where we're at. And where we're at is that, you know, democracy is very fragile, and we have this incredible opportunity at the local level. Like, rather than focus so much, especially now in the United States, everyone's focusing on the, you know, election, but the truly the heart of democracy, ground zero of democracy, is in your local community. And that's where we can bridge the divides, where we can rebuild trust. You know, so goes the city, so goes the nation. If we can rebuild our cities, then we can rebuild the nation. And to me, it helps to look at it as a great opportunity as opposed to a treacherous, you know, path.
That's a great note to end on, except I did want to ask you, you've been doing your civility tour now for nearly 5 years. I don't think you expected it would be going on so long. Do you see a time where you won't need to travel the country talking about why this is such a problem and calling for civic culture renewal?
I hope so. I do believe that that there is the possibility for a transformation in consciousness. You know, we did see it with the civil rights movement. You know, you saw it with apartheid. You know, there could just be a point where people, like even with civil wars, they mostly end from exhaustion. You know, and I do sense that people are exhausted with the conflict. And in the United States in particular, there seems to be a lot of philanthropic organizations able to fund a lot of really great grassroots initiatives around breaking the polarization and bringing people together, less so in Canada. But, you know, like we're all interconnected now. So what happens in one place, you know, will affect what's happening in others. And I think it's becoming really rather, I don't want to say uncool, but at a certain point, it, you know, it doesn't look like responsible conduct. You know, people are looking for that kind of, I think there's an appetite for wisdom again. I think there's an appetite for good stewardship. And I've actually seen it, like we have in one city, we have a previous counselor who was a conservative, and he had done a lot of work in the finance area. He took a platform on the basis of unity to unite all the division in his city and all the huge social problems that he was facing. And because he'd worked in finance, you know, the more liberal candidate for mayor who was an incumbent who was supposed to definitely was expected to win was offering a 0% tax increase. And this conservative guy reflected, you know, objectively on the finances of the city and the number of potholes and the infrastructure that had to be done. And he's like, you know, folks, we're going to need to have a substantial tax increase and a levy, and we're going to deal with homelessness because the people need to be cared for. And we're going to do this. And all these things that sound wildly unpopular, and he won. And so, you know, people were asked why, like, how did that happen? Like, nobody expected, even the media was absolutely shocked. And there was the sense that because he was talking about unity, because he was telling the people the truth about the, you know, the impacts of COVID, the impacts of inflation, you know, what was going to take to be sustainable. He wasn't just promising these white elephant projects or what people want to hear. He was really just trying to, in a very not like very, you know, humble way, tell them the truth of the situation and try and, you know, collectively work together. And he committed to working with all the community organizations, which he continues to do to this day in a nonpartisan way. And so I think there's an appetite for that kind of leadership. And when that happens, then we're going to be focusing more in the creative energy of how do we renew culture as opposed to how do we just beat these toxic situations? Because, I mean, how long can you have a lust for destruction, right?
Yeah, exactly. There's a thought for some positivity in the future. Thank you, Diane. It's been wonderful to speak with you and to get your thoughts on just why incivility is such an issue for communities and what you and others hopefully are doing to address that. All the very best with those endeavors.
Thank you very much. And thank you again for this incredible podcast that you're running. And I do expect, you know, it's already gone global and I expect its reach to go even further.
That's very kind of you to say. Thank you, Diane. My guest today, Diane Kalin-Sucre. You can find out more about her work from her website, dianekalinsucre.com. I hope you've enjoyed this special edition of the podcast, brought to you by the Victorian Local Governance Association, with support from Davidson Recruitment and Business Advisory Services. Regular editions are returning soon when we get underway with Season 4 of The Roundup, but check your podcast queue for more special editions of the program in the meantime. Thanks for listening, and bye for now. The Local Government News Roundup is brought to you by the Victorian Local Governance Association. As Victorian councils go to elections later this year, the VLGA is ready to support communities and councils in good governance. A series of workshops has been designed to increase understanding of the local government sector, the work of councils, and the role of a councillor. Registrations are being taken now for workshops in May on standing for local government and local women leading change. And member councils should look out for the VLGA's 2024 Local Government Election Pre-Candidate Prospectus, available soon. Find out more about how the VLGA can support your council and community during this important time in the local government election cycle. Visit vlga.org.au.